Periods, puberty, birth control. These are all topics that affect millions of teens, but we rarely talk about them openly. Today, we're changing that. Whether you're navigating your first cycle or just want to understand your body better, this episode is your go-to guide for all things teen girls' health. Welcome back to another episode of White Coats Real Talk. I'm Akshar Anand.
And I'm your co-host, Afar Vanon. We're so excited to welcome Dr. Julia Krohn to the podcast. She serves as site chief of obstetrics and gynecology at New York Presbyterian Queens Hospital and vice chair in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian. Before this, she led the OBGYN residency program at Yale and completed her training at Johns Hopkins, so she brings a wealth of experience when it comes to shaping the future of women's health. She specializes in general OBGYN care and holds a focus practice designation in pediatric and adolescent gynecology, which means she's one of the best people to answer the question so many teens are afraid to ask. Dr. Khan, thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy
Wonderful.
to be talking to teens about teens.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. But anyways, let's just dive right in. So one of the most important topics for teens and periods, hormones and puberty. And periods start at different times, as we know, but what do you think is the usual age range, and should someone be concerned about starting too late or too early?
Yeah, so I usually talk about puberty following a normal sequence and a normal tempo, right? So, because I am a gynecologist, I'm talking about puberty in people assigned female at birth, right? So, we're talking about people that are XX chromosomes. I don't know that much about the XY chromosome humans, but I can talk a lot about the XX humans. And just for, I think to put it out there for convention's sake, we will talk about these as girls and young women, even though some people who are assigned female at birth don't identify as that. And there are those that are XY and identify as female. But we'll, I think, for convention's sake, talk about girls and young women and kind of go with the assumption today in this setting that those are the XX, right? Okay, so again, puberty follows a normal sequence and tempo. In terms of sequence, what we usually see is breast development is the first thing. And then we see hair development, so hair, pubic hair. Then most girls go through a growth spurt. And then the final thing, which we talk about as like the culmination of puberty, is actually the menstrual cycle. And so those events of puberty usually take about 2 years. So a lot of people get really worried if they have breast development at, say, 8 years old, they're going to get their period a couple weeks later. And I usually tell people you have about 2 years to kind of prepare for that final event of puberty. And then a lot of people also want to know after they get their period, are they going to grow anymore, right? Because that growth spurt usually happens before puberty. Sometimes, unfortunately, girls usually don't grow that much after they have had their first period. Sometimes a little bit, but not a whole lot. And then your question was, when do we worry? Is it too early or too late? So we usually think the earliest puberty starts is around 8, and then the latest that is kind of normal to get your period is 16. So if any of those things are happening before 8, we usually recommend evaluation. And if a girl hasn't gotten her period, usually we talk about starting a workup at around 15, but 16 at the latest. And then the other thing to think about, remember I said sequence. So if you have like hair development before breast development, or if you have bleeding before breast development, that means a sign that like something might not be going on. The other thing is, again, remember those that 2 year rule. It's not really a rule, but a 2 year guideline. If you have breast development at, say, 10, and then you don't get your period till like 14, you think maybe something's going on there too. So normal sequence, normal tempo, and then kind of the bookends 8 and like 16.
Yeah, okay, for sure. And for a lot of people, periods are like still confusing as they've just gotten it recently. And for others, they've just seen as bleeding. But there's a lot more happening behind the scenes, as of course you know. From the first cramp to the last pad, can you walk us through what actually happens during a period? in more detail in a way that's easier for our younger audience to understand.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I always try to explain these things to my patients because I think if you can understand what's happening, it really helps you understand like what's normal, what's not normal. And I always ask people, what are you learning in school about this? And some people are learning a lot and some people are learning not a lot. And then, the other source is obviously the internet, social media, and some of the stuff out there is good, like what you guys are doing today. And some of it's not so good. Okay, so when you think about the period, think of it as a first of all, the female anatomy, right? So you have the ovaries, which are the things that make the hormones. This is interesting. I don't have any like visuals. We're just talking about this. So you have your ovaries that make the hormones. Then the ovaries, there's the fallopian tubes, and then there's the uterus, right? And the uterus has a lining that we call the endometrium. And then the lining sheds and there's bleeding into the vagina. And the vagina is kind of the pathway between the uterus and the like external world. And so that's kind of the like below the belly button, right? But then importantly, there is a brain ovary connection. So I like to think of it as like the brain, then the ovaries, then the uterus. And here's what happens when you are in your teen years, right? And you are starting to go through puberty, your brain starts making hormones that stimulate the ovaries. And when you get to a point where that's a very kind of coordinated thing, then your ovaries become more mature. And so the two ovary hormones are estrogen and progesterone. And so when you have that coordinated process, your brain stimulates the ovaries to make estrogen and progesterone. And then eventually, and what that is doing is actually stimulating the uterus. And so the whole, well, not, I mean, some would argue the whole purpose of the uterus is to hold a baby, right? So those hormones are like getting things ready for a pregnancy, right? And so what happens is your ovary is stimulated by hormones. It then releases an egg. The egg is, when that happens, it's called ovulation. And then the uterus is getting very excited and very ready, right? That this egg is going to go down the fallopian tubes, arrive in the uterus, and then the uterus, that egg in the uterus is waiting for a pregnancy. So it's waiting for a sperm, right? And if the egg and the sperm meet, and there's fertilization, and it implants, and it becomes a fetus. It goes on to be a pregnancy, right? If that egg goes to the ovary and doesn't meet anything, doesn't meet a partner, that lining that has gotten all ready for that pregnancy is like, oh, bummer, right? And so then the hormones change, and the hormone levels drop, and then the lining sheds. And that's your period. And then it kind of starts all over. And it starts like every month. So I think those are all like, if you can understand that, and like, this is what I wish that everyone was learning in health class, then you can kind of really understand like things about birth control, things about normal periods, like what is abnormal. And so that whole process takes about a month. And we usually say like the ideal cycle is 28 days. And so that process like recycles itself every 28 days.
Yeah, and you briefly mentioned like hormones, but can you kind of tell us some of the hormonal changes that girls in their puberty like experience? And then also, how can someone tell what would be normal and what might be a sign to check in with a doctor?
Yeah. So I think when you're thinking about your periods, so the important hormones are estrogen and progesterone. Those are the two female hormones. Interestingly, females do make a little bit of testosterone, the male hormone, and that's kind of important in the whole cycle. Some females make too much testosterone, and then that can be a problem. But those are the estrogen and progesterone are the big ones that we think about. When I think about hormones, I think about, again, normal cycle length, right? So time in between your periods. And we usually say that's about 21 to 45 days. So if you are having your period more frequently than every 21 days, that's a time to get checked out. Or if you are consistently going 45 or more days in between your period. So that means the cycle length is not normal. Importantly, it takes young women, girls, about 2, sometimes 3 years to get their cycles normal, right? So if a young person occasionally skips a period or is going maybe 50 days, 60 days, in the first couple years, that's okay. After, so for example, if you are get your first period at 11, by 14 or 15, you should be having those cycles every 21 to 45 days. So that's kind of thinking about the time in between your periods. Then you think about the actual length of the period, right? And we usually say the period is about 5 to 7 days. So if you, and we generally don't worry if it's shorter, right? So if you have a 3 or 4 day period, maybe you get lucky. But if you have a 12-day period, that's not normal, right? So if someone is bleeding for more than 2 weeks, that's usually not normal. And that's usually a good time to see a doctor. So we talked about cycle length, we talked about the duration of your period. Then we also think about amount of bleeding. And this is a tricky one because this is hard to like know how much is enough and how much is not enough. And I would say, back to your point about this isn't always a topic people talk about. People don't talk about it in their families, or they're embarrassed to talk about it with their friends, and maybe it's not talked about in their health class. So a lot of young people don't know what's normal. In general, I would say about 5 to 10, sorry, about 5 tampons or pads in a 24-hour period is okay. Now that's hard, right? Because some people change their pads every hour. Some people wait till their pads are really full. But in general, if your pads or tampons are filling and you have to change them about 5 times a day, that's okay. If it's less than that, that's great. If it's more than that, you should probably get checked out. The other signs I think about are like if it's leaking through your clothes, if like your sheets or pajamas are soaked at night, like all of that stuff is usually not normal. So that's kind of the amount of bleeding. You know, if somebody is like soaking through a pad every couple hours, that's not normal. Going along with that, if you are having lots of bleeding, you can get anemic, right? Like anemia means your blood count is low. So if you are having your period and you are feeling dizzy or lightheaded, any of that is also time to talk to someone about seeing a doctor. And then I think the other category of periods is pain, right? So what is normal pain, right? And a lot of people will be out there and then, you know, oh, my health teacher or my friend or my mom told me that this was all normal. And having some mild cramps and mild pain is normal. But the signs of things that are not normal are if your pain with your period is impacting your life. So if it is preventing you from going to school or spending time with your friends or doing the things you like to do, that's usually a time to see somebody because I always say, like, girls shouldn't be missing school because of their periods, right? And we can do lots of things to make it better. So pain is also a tricky one. It's pretty normal to have to take some Motrin or Advil or ibuprofen during your period. But if you're taking those medicines and it's still not getting better, that's a good time to see somebody. And then the last category is all the other kind of terrible things that can go along with your period. So some people notice mood problems. Some people get really nauseous. Some people get this like faint dizziness feeling. Some people get terrible headaches. All of those things are a sign that you should maybe see a doctor, and you know, see if there's something you can do about it.
Yeah, and so you also mentioned that like periods for girls and that are getting it between like 11 to 14, for example, if you got it when you're 11, they're very sparse and like the frequencies changes often. So if you don't know exactly when your period is going to be, is there any signs we can see before getting our period that might help us know when we'll get it the week of or the week after, if we really don't know, like have a idea of when it would be because of just how infrequent it is.
Yeah. And I always recommend, like, there's a lot of really good apps out there to track your period. You know, some people track it kind of old school on a calendar, which is fine, but there all are also a lot of apps out there. I think even some of the apps that come with your phone, like you can, the health apps, you can check your track your periods, but it is a good idea to track it. And especially if you're thinking like, I'm not sure this is normal. And, you know, maybe I'm going to go to the doctor and check it out. It's really great if you come to the doctor and you're like, oh, look, here's all of my information. But there are the signs often of like when it's coming. Some people notice like a little bit of cramping before they get their period. Some people notice a change in their discharge. So maybe like a little bit of mucus, a little bit of like clear discharge that's not like itching or burning. That can all happen before the period. The other thing a lot of people notice before their period is mood changes, right? So there's a lot of people that are like, my mood, I felt terrible. And then I got my period and I feel better. And they're like, oh, that's why my mood was so bad. So that's an important thing to kind of see if there's patterns for that. Some people notice some increased cravings in certain foods. Some people notice like more fatigue or less energy during their period or like before they actually get their period.
Another topic that we wanted to touch on is a lot of teens don't hear about conditions such as endometriosis, PCOS, or iron deficiency. And even these can sometimes be the reason behind painful or irregular periods. Can you kind of explain what these conditions are, how early they can appear in teens, and what should parents and teens know about early detection and when it's time to check in with a doctor?
Yeah, great. I was hoping you were going to ask these questions. Okay, so let's talk about endometriosis first. So remember we talked about that lining tissue, right? That's kind of like the home for the future fetus, right? So sometimes that lining tissue can be outside of the uterus. So it can be like on the ovaries, it can be on the tubes, it can even be on the like bowels, the intestines, or the bladder. And so what happens is, remember when we were talking about like that home for the potential fetus getting ready, if that tissue is outside of the uterus, it can cause terrible pain. And then when you get, remember we talked about like the, okay, there's no fetus, now that lining sheds. When that happens, imagine that inside your body and it's not like shedding. That is when you get terrible pain. So we worry about, and the classic story with endometriosis is pain during the periods that is really severe, right? It is the ones that can't go to school, prefer not to do fun things with their friends. Like if the period is really impacting your life, then endometriosis is a consideration. And, you know, again, we usually say, all right, try some like Motrin, Advil. And if you're taking Motrin and Advil all day long and it's not working, then we worry about endometriosis. And maybe right now we should use a little bit of the time to talk about what do you do if you think you have endometriosis, right? So you go to a doctor, they may or may not do an ultrasound to look at the uterus and the ovaries because sometimes they're looking for other things. And importantly, you usually can't see endometriosis on an ultrasound, right? Because endometriosis is kind of like this microscopic thing. So people that have terrible periods with a normal ultrasound, we suspect endometriosis. Now, importantly, the only way to truly diagnose endometriosis in 2025, maybe things are going to change and we're going to have genetic testing in some in your lifetime, but the only way we can diagnose it is through surgery where we actually look. So we put a camera into your belly button and we look. We look at the ovaries and the uterus, and then we can see endometriosis. Now, a lot of times, most of the time, particularly in teens, we usually don't jump right to surgery. So we often say, okay, well, let's assume it's endometriosis and let's treat it. And we usually treat it with what I like to call hormonal modification. And the most common way to do hormonal modification is through birth control pills. And remember, we talked about that and estrogen and progesterone. So birth control pills have estrogen and progesterone, and it basically quiets all of that lining tissue that's going crazy. And the reason why I call it hormonal modification is that a lot of people, particularly maybe parents and guardians, are very nervous and scared of birth control pills. But really, the birth control part of it is just a small part of the benefit that you get from that hormonal modification. So I always tell my patients, I wish we had called it like the period pill or the hormonal modulator, birth control pills, because it really, like, birth control pills offer so much benefit besides just preventing pregnancy. So we usually manage endometriosis with birth control pills, and it usually does a really good job. So that is a great way to manage endometriosis. Okay, let's move on. And then the question is, like, who gets surgery? And it's usually if we try the birth control pills and it's not working, then we have to think about other things. The second category that everybody asks me about is PCOS, right? So PCOS stands for polycystic ovary syndrome. Okay. And remember, we talked about that well-coordinated, like, brain ovary uterus connection. PCOS is when things kind of go awry. And we characterize PCOS as when you do not have that ovulation, right? When you do not release an egg. So you don't have this very coordinated hormonal system. And it is characterized by too much testosterone. Okay. Remember, we talked about females make some testosterone, but in PCOS, they make too much. So they're not ovulating. And we kind of are unclear of, like, what comes first, right? Is it like the abnormal, like, how does this all go awry? And there's lots of really smart people studying that. But we don't know exactly why the system goes awry, but it does. And so you don't have that coordinated system and you have too much testosterone. And the result is that you usually don't get your period frequently enough. So the most common scenario for PCOS is I mean, it's adults too. So people get their period like every 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And then when they get it, it's like crazy. So they usually will get a period like every 4 months and it's a terrible period. And that is the classic story of the period with PCOS. Often, if you go to the doctor with those symptoms, they will check your testosterone level. So we often see irregular periods and elevated testosterone levels. And then, why is it called PCOS? So those people usually have lots of cysts on their ovaries. And so sometimes we do an ultrasound. Now, importantly, in teens often have cysts on their ovaries. So the ultrasound and the cysts are not as important a component of the diagnosis of PCOS as it is like in adult women. I think the other important thing to talk about with PCOS is its connection to weight and diabetes and prediabetes. We know that in people that are overweight, they are more likely to have PCOS because the fat cells actually make some hormones. So we think if there is an excess in fat cells, it can contribute to that hormonal craziness and put you at risk of PCOS. Now, there's like exceptions to every rule. There are thin women, girls who have PCOS, but many have an excess in weight. The other thing we know is that if you lose weight, so if you have someone who is overweight and they lose weight, their hormones actually get better and their periods actually get better. So often in people that have too much testosterone and irregular periods and they are overweight, we suggest losing weight. It's also associated with prediabetes and diabetes. And so we know if they can lose some weight, it will help reduce the risk of diabetes and prediabetes. I think importantly, my last comment on PCOS in young people is I usually say, you are at risk for PCOS because it's hard to make that diagnosis in a teen. So we usually talk about like at risk for PCOS, and we talk about the benefits of like hormonal modification and diet and exercise.
Amazing. And I think now we know more about PCOS and endometriosis. So moving on to mental health and body image, what are some common body worries do you hear from teen patients? And how do you as a doctor in this field help them feel more at ease and comfortable talking with you?
Great question. As you probably are well aware, I think we have a bit of a mental health crisis going on right now with our teens. And I think teens are dealing with a lot, and that includes body image, right? So we see body image, people with body image issues at like all the spectrum, right? And I would say this is an area where social media is not helping us, right? Like, there's lots of good things about social media, but there's a lot, like the body image thing is where young people are looking at unrealistic images, right? And I think that can be really, really harmful. You know, I think back before we had social media, you guys could probably never imagine a world without social media. But when I was your age, we didn't have social media. And like we looked in magazines, right? And so we were limited in what we could look at. Social media is now like in your face 24/7, right? And so if you're always looking at these unrealistic images, it's hard to not be affected by that. So I think, you know, we have to be careful. And I think we have to talk about the fact that, like, just like there's a million different shoe sizes, there's, you know, everybody has different body shapes, body sizes, breast size, right? Like, we humans come in a lot of varieties. And I think we have to kind of like celebrate that instead of talking about like the ideal. And again, back to even our conversations about PCOS and overweight, you know, we have to be careful because what we don't want, we want people to be at a healthy weight and have a health. Try to talk about like healthy relationship with food, right? And so for everybody, that's a little different. And if you know, I worry sometimes talking about losing weight and then it goes like too far, right? Like, we want everybody to have like a healthy relationship with food and exercise. And exercise is great, but if you are, you know, running 15 miles a day and missing out on the things that bring you joy with your family or friends because you have to run 15 miles a day, like, that's a problem, right? And so I think we have to be careful about that.
For sure. Everybody should love themselves and be confident with who they are.
Yeah, that's a great, great topic. Great, great statement.
Thank you. And so if a teen shares something really personal with their OBGYN doctor, does it stay private or can parents find out? And what are some rules around confidentiality in teen healthcare? And why do you think it's so important for young people to really understand their rights and in this field and when it comes to their health?
That is a great question, and that is like one of my favorite topics. So I think to establish what we call kind of like a therapeutic relationship, it is really important for a teen to be able to trust their doctor, right? Now, I am actually also the parent of a teen and young adult, so I have some sympathy and empathy for the parents out there in the world. But teen, you know, you got to put yourself in your parents' shoes a little bit. And it's really hard to make that transition from like, imagine bringing your 5-year-old to the doctor and being super involved and knowing everything, right? You know what they are eating at any moment, you know when they go to the bathroom, right? And then you have to like make that transition to giving them independence. And it's hard. And I think when it's done in a gradual, safe way, it can be super effective, right? And so I feel like we have to engage parents, but then what I do is I tell parents, listen, like, don't you want your child getting their information from me instead of social media? So we need to have a relationship where they can talk to me and ask me the questions in private, right? And then I think the responsibility lies on the teen to start kind of managing their own healthcare, right? So there's lots of places where you can have portals where you can get information from your doctor, you can message with your doctor, and learning to do that is the same as like learning to do your own laundry and like learning to cook food for yourself. You know, I always say, like, when people are entering the end of their high school years, entering college, like, you got to learn to do your laundry, you got to learn to cook for yourself, and you need to learn how to communicate with your doctor. Like, it's a really important part of growing up. And so when I meet with a new patient, you know, often we'll have the patient, their parent or guardian, and we have a conversation, all of us. And then almost always, and this usually starts in the teen years, I say, okay, now it's time for the parent to leave. And now it's time for us to have that private conversation. And if you set it up in a way that is not threatening to the parent, right? Like, again, this conversation, like, don't you want me to, don't you want your child to have a place where they can ask questions? Most parents are fine with that. And I like to say, like, your child needs a dentist, an eye doctor, like a primary care doctor, and then they should have somebody that they can talk to about private reproductive health and otherwise. So I really try to ensure confidentiality. Now, your question of like, can be kind of reported interestingly, especially in the world that we are kind of living in right now, where reproductive rights are being challenged. It is very state specific. So I think it's important for teens to know the laws of their state. In New York, I am kind of fortunate enough to have the ability to have a lot, teens have a lot of protection in New York. And one thing you can do is look up online, like, what are the laws in your state? There are certain, like, for example, in New York, there's an organization called the ACLU. New York ACLU has put out a document that says, here are the rights of teens. And I imagine it exists in other states. I don't know what, if it exists in other states, but it like spells out all of the rules in the state of New York. So it's important for teens to know what their rules are. So for example, in New York, the medical record of the teen is actually quite protected. And unfortunately, that's not the same in all states. So when I have a conversation with a patient, I usually say, like, what we talk about is between us, but there are exceptions to that rule. So if I think you're in danger of hurting yourself, or hurting someone else, or if someone is hurting you, then actually by law, I do need to report that. So there are lots of protections, and there's lots of protections about talking about reproductive health and even prescribing birth control. But there are also protections of teen safety, and there are instances where we really actually do have to report things.
Amazing. So now moving on to more personal questions about you and your life.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, so you've held some leadership roles at some of the nation's top institutions and practiced there, like Yale, Johns Hopkins, and now Cornell. What really inspired you to pursue medicine in the first place, and why'd you pick OBGYN?
Great question. So I think when I think way back to like when I was your age, like when I was in high school, I just like I was very drawn to my biology class, right? Like I loved biology. It was like so cool to like learn about how like animals, plants, humans, like how things work. I was very drawn to that. So I entered college thinking like I would probably be a biology major. And in fact, I was. And I just was, and then I kind of transitioned to like the human biology was super interesting to me. And to be honest, it was like my college mentors and professors that really encouraged me to apply to med school. Once you meet people that are like, yeah, you can do it. Like, I think that was really like the turning point for me when people said, yeah, I think you can do it. So I try to be the mentor to a lot of teens, and I think all teens need those adults that are really going to advocate for them and help them and encourage them, right? So when I graduated from college, I actually worked in Washington, D.C. at the American College of OBGYNs. And that was my first exposure to the field of OBGYN. And I was just like, wow, this is totally amazing. And for me, the like relationship between medicine and actually health policy and government, like OBGYN has a lot of interplay between patient care and public policy, like, again, going back to like reproductive health laws. And so we as OBGYNs are really involved in that because we want to protect the rights of our patients and we want to be able for our patients to have access to, reproductive health care. So I was very drawn, and I also met like a ton of OBGYNs that I really liked. And I was like, wow, I could picture myself doing that. And so when I went to medical school and I was kind of went with the open mind of like, okay, I'm gonna like try everything. And then I wound up kind of comparing everything to OBGYN. And in the end, That is one out. And for me, like OBGYN is kind of a little bit of everything, right? So we do a little bit of primary care, right? Like people go to their OBGYNs every year to get that kind of routine care. So we do that. We do procedures, right? So I do surgeries, which is amazing. The most amazing thing is to deliver a baby. Like it is like second to none. And I just like love it. It's like this amazing thing. So that was probably the thing that totally put me over the edge. We also do like a little bit of mental health care. We do a little bit of everything. And for me, like I never do the same thing 2 days in a row, right? Yesterday, I actually was delivering babies. Today, I'm, doing my administrative work. Like I'm kind of working on how to make our hospital policies better and things like that. So OBGYN is like a very diverse field, and you can do like a little bit of everything, which I really liked. Again, a part of my journey was how I transitioned to be like a teen gynecologist. And that stemmed from when I started in practice. I actually just wound up seeing a lot of young people. And I think it was because I was young back then. I wound up seeing all these teens, and I was like, wow, I really love taking care of teenagers, right? They're like at this point where they're going through all these challenging times. And if I can help them through that, like that would be really rewarding. And it has been. And it's a little bit like taking care of pregnant patients, right? So pregnant patients are going through these massive transitions in their life. It's like really, they're really nervous. They don't know what's happening, a lot of anxiety. Like teenagers are going through a lot of the same thing. So like OB, like obstetrics, delivering babies and taking care of pregnant patients is actually kind of similar to taking care of teenagers. And then, another part of my career has been as like an educator. And I think that stems from my parents were both teachers. So like I've always have been drawn to that. I like, as you might notice, I like explaining things to people. And so I have been the really good fortune of being able to work with medical students. And I was the residency program director at Yale. So I was able to kind of help lead people through learning about OBGYN, and being like a career mentor is pretty awesome. I mean, I still get phone calls from some of my former residents asking me for advice. I mean, that's like the ultimate, I don't know, compliment to me. And my job at Cornell is that I am in charge of one of the Cornell Hospital OBGYN departments. So now I'm actually like building an OBGYN department and like building a practice and making sure that like we're providing really high quality care for patients here. And I like that. Like that's, I'm learning new things and it's challenging, and learning how to navigate some of the difficulties with hospitals. And I, all throughout this, I've never given up actual patient care. As I said, yesterday I was delivering babies and I still see patients in my office. And to me, like, that is the core, because you can't understand how to change a system unless you actually take care of patients. And I like to make the analogy, it's kind of like you can't be a principal if you've actually never been in a classroom, right? So how do you run a school if you don't know what your teachers are doing and if you don't know what your students are learning? So I've always felt like it's been really important for me to still have that like patient contact. So.
Amazing. You're very inspiring. I'm sure a lot of people look up to you and who knows this field. And so, what advice would you give to high school or college students thinking about becoming OBGYNs or going into medicine in general?
So I think the first thing is like go for it, right? Like if this is what you want to do, you should do it. And I think getting exposure to as many different people you can is great. And you'll meet people along the way who might tell you not to do it, right? That's why you got to talk to a million people, and you got to get like a million different opinions. And you don't have to take every piece of advice. Like people will give you very different advice. But I think just exposure is really important. And then exposure to different people, different ideas, do what feels right. You think, and it's important to find those people that will advocate for you. I think all of us in our life, no matter what you choose as your profession, is like every young person needs that adult, trusted adult that will like advocate for them, and look, like seek out those people and, seek out different experiences. And like medicine's an amazing field. If it's what you want to do, you should go for it.
Wonderful. And lastly, to end off today's episode, what's one thing that you wish every teenage girl knew about her body? Something that could empower her as she navigates her health, identity, and her place in this world.
Great question. I think you asked for one thing, right? I think my one take home would be like the point of like we as humans come in lots of varieties, and diversity is actually our strength. And so there's not just one way to do things, there's not just one body type. And the caveat to that is seek out help when you need it and want it. Right. So recognize the diversity. But if you have questions of where you fit in this diverse world, seek out people that can help you answer those questions. And there's lots of experts out there in the world. And seek them out and ask the questions. And I would also add to that, be cautious of some of the things. Stuff that's out there. There is a fair amount of misinformation out there, and question it. Don't believe everything you see on social media. And I think to you two to be doing this is really great. Like teens need to have the resources that are from trusted sources. And I think you guys putting this out there is great because there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, I myself had a lot of questions, and hearing it straight from you who work specifically in this field and with teenagers really solidified most of my questions. Thank you so much, Dr. Kron, for joining us today. And as we wrap up, I hope that listeners take away more than just facts about periods or puberty, and that this conversation was really about understanding, embracing, and taking ownership of women's health as something that's personal and empowering.
Great. Well, I'm so happy to have done this.
Thank you so much. And everyone, thank you so much for listening and staying tuned for the next episodes. Be sure to check out the other episodes. And thank you again for listening.